Imagine handing the exact same massive data set, covering thousands of counties over an 11-year period, to two brilliant econometricians.
Right.
They both execute their analyses perfectly. Neither makes a single mathematical error. Yet the first one concludes that a specific policy intervention actually increased mortality. And the second one, looking at the exact same numbers, proves the policy decreased mortality and saved lives. Welcome to our deep dive.
Yeah, the mechanism driving that paradox is, well, it's what makes this specific analysis so crucial, because the divergence isn't a result of coding errors or differing software packages, you know.
Exactly.
It stems entirely from a single methodological choice regarding how to weight the underlying data, which, and this is the key, fundamentally redefines the estimand.
Which is our central mission today. We're acting as your comprehensive methodological study guide, walking through the modern difference in differences, or DIDDY pipeline.
Yeah.
We'll be using the Affordable Care Act's Medicaid expansion from 2014 to 2019 as our case study. For those of you listening, especially you graduate students in economics, the goal here is to understand how population weighting alters your target parameter when you're working with, you know, highly heterogeneous regional data.
Before we proceed, though, we do need to establish a clear parameter for our discussion today.
Always a good idea.
Because our source material utilizes the Affordable Care Act and Medicaid expansion, which is obviously a very politically charged policy, we are maintaining a strictly neutral methodological stance here.
Yeah, the mathematics of causal inference don't have a political party.
Exactly. We are purely analyzing the mechanics of causal inference, statistical estimators, and data geometry. We are not evaluating the policy itself, nor are we, you know, endorsing any political viewpoint.
Completely agreed. So mastering this pipeline from basic 2x2 cell means to the Callaway-Santa Ana estimators, and finally to Rambachan and Roth's sensitivity analysis, it's non-negotiable if you want to execute defensible observational research.
Right, it really is.
To start, we have to examine the identifying assumption at the root of all of this, which is the parallel trends assumption. As graduate students, you're well aware that this assumes, counterfactually, that the treated and control groups would have followed parallel trajectories absent the intervention.
Building on that baseline, we can test this using the simplest possible estimator, which is the 2x2 average treatment effect on the treated, or ATT.
Right, the classic 2x2.
Yeah. So we're calculating the difference in the post-period and pre-period means for the treated group, and then simply subtracting the difference in the post-period and pre-period means for the control group.
Let's actually look at the arithmetic for the 2014 Medicaid expansion cohort. Let's start with the unweighted data, where every county, regardless of its population, is treated as an equal unit of observation.
Okay.
The treated group's mortality trend increased by 9.27 deaths per 100,000, and the control group's trend increased by 9.15.
So they're moving pretty closely together.
Right. So plugging those into the 2x2 formula, the ATT is positive 0.12 deaths per 100,000.
And that positive 0.12 essentially implies a null effect, or maybe a very marginal increase in mortality. But the paradox emerges when you apply a population weight to the exact same data set, weighting by the adult population of each county.
This is where it gets wild.
Yeah, the treated trend drops to positive 3.74, and the control trend registers a positive 6.3. So the resulting 2x2 ATT flips entirely to negative 2.56 deaths per 100,000.
It's a total sign reversal, but the crucial observation here isn't just the final number, it's the deltas. Mm-hmm. If you look at the baseline pre-period gap between the treated and control groups, it is virtually identical across both weighting regimes.
Wait, let's clarify that for the listeners. What are the exact numbers?
Sure. Unweighted, the gap is negative 54.77. Population weighted, it is negative 53.68. The math proves that this entire sign reversal is driven exclusively by how the weights manipulate the post-period averages.
That's a huge distinction. And the underlying reason for this shift is that applying weights redefines your target parameter. It's not just, you know, an adjustment for precision or heteroscedasticity.
Yeah. Wait, I really want to push back on that, or at least play devil's advocate. Is this really not just a loss of precision when we weight the data?
No, not at all. It changes the actual question you're asking. When you run the unweighted calculation, your estimand is the effect of the policy on the typical county.
Okay.
But when you run the population-weighted calculation, your estimand shifts to the effect of the policy on the typical adult. You're asking fundamentally different questions of the same data matrix.
Like comparing a classroom average versus a student average.
Exactly. That classroom versus student analogy is perfect.
So moving from the conceptual arithmetic to implementation, we have to consider how to execute this within standard econometric software. The sources detail the algebraic equivalency of three standard models on a perfectly balanced 2x2 panel.
Right, the levels regression, a two-way fixed effects or TWFE regression, and a long difference regression.
Mechanically, all three converge on the exact same interaction coefficient, don't they?
They do. For the levels regression, you estimate the outcome as a function of a constant, a treatment dummy, a post-period dummy, and the interaction of treatment and post.
Yep.
For the TWFE model, you include entity and time fixed effects. And for the long difference model, you simply regress the change in the outcome between the post and pre periods on the treatment indicator.
Let's unpack the matrix algebra intuition for why they all converge. In a perfectly balanced two-period panel, differencing the data across time physically sweeps out the time invariant entity fixed effects, right?
Exactly.
And the intercept in that long difference regression absorbs the time fixed effect. Consequently, all three models numerically output the exact same positive 0.122 unweighted coefficient.
And the exact same negative 2.563 weighted coefficient.
Exactly. So the only substantive methodological choice that alters the point estimate in this balanced 2x2 setting is the weighting matrix.
But here's the catch. Relying on unconditional parallel trends here presents a severe structural problem. The treated and control counties are profoundly imbalanced across baseline covariates.
Yeah, let's talk about how we measure that imbalance using the normalized difference equation.
Right.
In the econometric literature, a normalized difference exceeding 0.25 in absolute value indicates an imbalance severe enough to threaten the unconfoundedness assumption.
It's a major red flag.
A huge one. Looking at the unweighted sample, the expansion counties are statistically distinct. They are whiter, with a normalized difference of positive 0.586. and wealthier at positive 0.427.
And the complication just compounds when you apply population weights. The imbalance doesn't resolve itself, it just shifts dimensions.
Right.
Under population weighting, the most severe imbalance moves to the baseline unemployment rate, registering at positive 0.503. So assuming that these deeply heterogeneous geographical units would follow perfectly parallel mortality trajectories, unconditional on their baseline economic indicators, is
an indefensible leap.
Exactly, an indefensible leap.
I want to examine the propensity score densities provided in the source material for a second. A naive assumption might be that weighting would smooth out these distributions, but it actually destroys the covariate overlap.
It really does.
The treated and control distributions pull completely apart. Mechanically, why does weighting ruin the overlap so badly?
It's a function of demographic concentration. When you population weight, massive highly populous treated counties like Los Angeles County, for example, consume a disproportionate share of the statistical weight.
Oh, I see.
And similarly, massive non-expansion counties in Texas absolutely dominate the control group. You're effectively forcing a few demographic megacenters to define the conditional means.
Which physically pulls the propensity distributions to opposite ends of the support.
Right, and the common support assumption just fails completely.
So because the unconditional parallel trends assumption is structurally compromised by this imbalance, we are forced to move to conditional parallel trends via covariate adjustment.
Which brings us to doubly robust difference in differences, or DRDID.
We need to break down the mechanics of how this estimator attempts to salvage the unconfoundedness assumption.
Sure. So DRDID integrates two distinct covariate adjustment techniques. The first is outcome regression, or OR.
Okay, how does that work mechanically?
Mechanically, you regress the outcome on the covariates within the control group to estimate a conditional mean function. You then use that function to predict the counterfactual post-treatment outcomes for the treated group.
Basically building a counterfactual from the control group's behavior. And the second component is inverse propensity weighting, or IPW, right?
Yes. Here we estimate a propensity score, which is just the probability of treatment given the covariates. We then apply weights to the control units proportional to that score divided by 1 minus that score.
Which physically reweights the control group's covariate distribution so its moments match the treated group's distribution.
Exactly. So the doubly robust estimator combines these two approaches. It calculates the ATT by taking the sample average of a doubly robust influence function.
Like a belt and suspenders approach.
That's a great analogy. For each county, it takes a weighting residual based on its actual treatment status and its estimated propensity score, and multiplies that by the difference between the county's actual outcome and its predicted outcome from the outcome regression model.
And the theoretical guarantee of DRDID is that your final estimate remains consistent if either the outcome model or the propensity model is correctly specified, right? You don't need both to be perfect.
Right, just one or the other.
So applying this to our data, the DRDID weighted estimate shifts to negative 3.76. And for the unweighted data, the covariate adjustment pulls the original positive 0.12 down to negative 1.226.
Those point estimates really highlight the magnitude of the confounding in the unconditional models. By adjusting for the baseline imbalances in wealth, race, and unemployment, the unweighted estimate drops by more than a full death per 100,000, aligning closer to a mortality reduction.
Okay, I have to pause and look at the standard errors for these doubly robust estimates, though.
Yeah.
The weighted DRDID estimate is negative 3.756, but the standard error is massive. It's 3.29, which places the 95% confidence interval well across the zero line. In fact, reviewing the tables, not a single one of the six covariate adjusted estimators across either weighting scheme excludes zero.
They don't.
So my pushback is, does this complex matrix algebra actually buy us any statistical significance?
No, it does not. And honestly, that is a necessary reality check for any econometrician.
Yeah.
Covariate adjustment is not a tool for manufacturing statistical power out of thin air.
Right. So what does it buy you?
It buys you defensibility under observational identification. It shifts the interpretation to a conditional parameter, mitigating omitted variable bias. However, the underlying data generating process is just highly volatile.
The mortality data is simply too noisy to definitively reject the null hypothesis, regardless of how robust your conditional mean functions are.
Exactly.
Now, the limitation of our analysis thus far is time. The 2x2 design compresses 9 years of dynamic panel data into a single pre- and post-binary.
We're throwing away so much information.
Right. We're ignoring the fact that states expanded Medicaid in staggered cohorts, 2014, 2015, 2016, and 2019. We really need to expand the design dynamically, first with the 2xT design and then with the GxT design.
Let's isolate the 2xT design first. We introduce event time, denoted algebraically as E, which normalizes the treatment year to zero for all cohorts.
Okay, so the periods where E is less than or equal to negative 2 act as placebo tests?
Exactly. If the conditional parallel trends assumption holds, the coefficients on these leads should be statistically indistinguishable from zero. And the periods where E is greater than or equal to zero trace the dynamic treatment trajectory over time.
Let's look at those results. The unweighted 2xT trajectory climbs significantly, hitting positive 16.96 by E equals 5.
But standard TWFE regressions fail dramatically when treatment adoption is staggered. We have to address that.
Yeah, the mathematical flaw is that standard TWFE uses already treated units as effective controls for newly treated units, right?
Precisely. If the treatment effect changes over time, which we assume it does in these dynamic models, this introduces severe negative weighting biases. It's often referred to as the Goodman-Bacon decomposition problem.
You essentially contaminate your control group with dynamic treatment effects. It's like a relay race with staggered start times.
I like that.
You wouldn't evaluate a swimmer who just jumped in the pool by comparing them to a swimmer who is already halfway done with their lap and acting as their control.
That's exactly it. And that specific contamination is why the literature has rapidly adopted the Callaway-Santa Anna framework representing our GxT design.
Right.
Instead of a single contaminated regression, this estimator calculates a specific ATT for each group G at each time period.
Right.
It strictly uses either never-treated units or not-yet-treated units as the control group, entirely bypassing that negative weighting issue.
And then you aggregate these specific group time ATTs into an overall dynamic effect. So looking at the results of this disaggregated approach, they are highly sensitive to our weighting choice. The pooled GxT dynamic aggregate sits at positive 7.917 unweighted.
Uh-huh.
But when we apply population weights, it collapses to positive 0.266.
And that divergence is explained by profound cohort heterogeneity hiding within those aggregates. When you compute the group-specific ATTs, the 2014 cohort completely flips its sign from positive to negative underweighting.
Wow.
Conversely, the 2016 cohort produces a statistically significant massive negative effect underweighting, despite the fact that the 2016 expansion states represent only 2% of the total adult population in the sample.
That is a critical vulnerability. The population weighting is mechanically amplifying a tiny, anomalous subset of the data simply because of demographic concentration in a few specific counties within that 2016 cohort.
It really is.
Okay, so we have now built the most rigorous model available. We've eliminated negative weighting bias with Callaway Santa Ana, and we've controlled for confounding with doubly robust covariates.
Right.
But the entire architecture still rests on the assumption that post-treatment trends would exactly match pre-treatment trends. And we know that's rarely true in reality. How do we stress test a fundamentally unobservable assumption?
We implement Ramachan and Roth's Honest DIDE framework. This methodology moves away from requiring exact parallel trends and instead asks a different question. If the parallel trends assumption is violated in the post period, how severe must that violation be to overturn our statistical conclusion?
It formalizes this through a relative magnitudes parameter denoted as mbar, right?
Yes, mbar.
Mechanically, how does mbar bound the post-treatment violation?
The researcher specifies a set of allowed differences in post-treatment trends. Mbar restricts these post-period differences to be no larger than a specific multiple of the maximum observed violation in the pre-treatment periods.
Can you give an example?
Sure. For instance, if mbar equals 1, you are allowing the post-period trend to deviate from parallel by an amount up to, but no greater than, the largest deviation we already observed before the policy went into effect.
So we are testing the fragility of the point estimate against historical volatility.
Exactly.
When we examine the breakdown values for the unweighted data, the conclusion that the policy increased mortality breaks before mbar reaches 0.25.
Right.
Meaning if the post-period trend violation is even one quarter the magnitude of the worst pre-period violation, the statistical significance just disappears.
And the weighted data is even more fragile. At an mbar of exactly zero, meaning assuming perfectly exact parallel trends, the confidence interval is already a negative 6.07 to positive 6.07.
So it straddles zero from the very beginning.
Yes, meaning there was never a definitive directional sign to break in the first place. As you increase mbar toward one, both the weighted and unweighted models completely saturate the standard software grid limits of plus or minus 66.7.
I have to ask the obvious critical question here. If our entire robust econometric model collapses at just a 0.25 multiple of our pre-trend violations, and the confidence intervals explode instantly, isn't this entire analysis practically useless?
Yeah.
Have we just spent hours proving that we know nothing?
It's the exact opposite of useless. It provides mathematically rigorous proof of extreme fragility.
Okay, how so?
The value of Ramachan-Roth is that it quantifies uncertainty that was previously hidden behind a binary, pass or fail pre-trend test. In this specific pedagogical application, it proves definitively that the pre-trends convey almost no actionable information about the post-period counterfactual.
I see.
Discovering that your identifying assumption cannot withstand even mild historical volatility is highly valuable scientific output. It prevents you from publishing overly confident yet structurally flawed policy claims.
That makes total sense. Let's synthesize the study guide for our listeners. We initiated our analysis with a profound sign reversal in a basic 2x2 cell means. Positive 0.12 unweighted versus negative 2.56 weighted.
Right.
We mapped that arithmetic onto TWFE and long difference regressions, demonstrating algebraic equivalency. We then diagnosed a severe failure of covariate overlap and applied doubly robust DIDE to stabilize the estimates via conditional parallel trends.
And from there, we identified the Goodman-Bacon contamination inherent in standard TWFE when applied to staggered rollouts and resolved it using the Callaway Santa Ana G/T estimators.
And finally, we subjected our models to the Honest DIDE framework, proving that the conditional estimates were highly sensitive to even minor deviations from exact parallel trends.
So the overriding methodological takeaway for your own research is that the choice of weighting is not an afterthought. It dictates the estimate.
Exactly.
Neither estimate is inherently incorrect. If you are executing a federal cost-benefit analysis where the currency is human lives, the population-weighted estimate is required to capture the effect on the typical adult.
But conversely, if you are modeling heterogeneous local administrative effects, the unweighted estimate isolates the typical county.
Right. The rigor lies in intentionally aligning your econometric choices with your defined theoretical parameter, rather than just accepting default software behaviors. And once again, analyzing these estimators reflects an evaluation of statistical geometry, not an endorsement of the Affordable Care Act.
Absolutely. So for the graduate students listening, your call to action today is to audit your current research pipelines. Are you explicitly defining your target parameter before you run your first regression?
That's the big question.
Or are you accidentally changing your research question by applying demographic weights as a reflexive robustness check?
Because that level of intentionality is really what separates mechanical coding from rigorous causal inference.
To leave you with a final theoretical exercise throughout this analysis, we utilize the broad, crude death rate as our outcome variable. Consider what would happen if you substituted that broad outcome with a highly specific, narrowly defined variable such as drug-related overdoses.
Oh, that's interesting.
If you processed that data through this exact same pipeline, would the paradoxical sign reversal still emerge in the unweighted versus weighted cell means? And critically, would the Rambekan-Roth breakdown values demonstrate a more resilient parallel trends assumption, or would the diagnostic landscape become even more fragile?
It's something to think about, since the narrower the outcome, the more volatile the baseline geometry becomes.
Exactly. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive.